Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the Local News Roundup. Here we go again. North Carolina lawmakers announced their intention to redraw the congressional maps to add a Republican seat in the midterms. An outside attorney finds no unethical, immoral, or illegal conduct in the city's dealings in a settlement for CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings. Charlotte loses an industry leader. LendingTree's CEO Doug Lebda dies in an ATV accident. And despite what you might think, crime in Charlotte is down. Again. While other communities have pushed back against them, a data center is planned for uptown Charlotte and moving ahead without discussion. And what do my wondering eyes perceive? The Panthers have a chance at establishing a winning record on Sunday. Bring out the trumpets. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE climate reporter Zachary Turner. Ben Thompson is here. He's an anchor at WCNC-TV. Mary C. Curtis is columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. And Eric Spanberg is the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Hi, everybody. Welcome.
Morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Hey.
Morning. Well, it started in Texas with a response from California, and now it's spread to North Carolina. And of course, I'm talking about lawmakers redrawing congressional maps to improve the chance of one party over another to control Congress. Texas responded to Donald Trump's request to add Republicans to maintain control of that body after next year's midterm elections. California's governor asked for and received permission to put a referendum on that state's ballot in November to do the same, but to favor Democrats and to counter Texas. So, what is North Carolina's excuse, Ben?
Well, I think when it comes to gerrymandering, and I say this sometimes on TV, I can't think of a least captivating but more consequential issue that really nobody completely understands. So as it stands right now, we have 14 members in the House that represent the state of North Carolina. Right now, it's separated by 10 Republicans and 4 Democrats. This would change that now to 11 Republicans and 3 Democrats. That is notable, Mike, because that would give Republicans 79% of the state's House delegation when they only represent about 31% of registered voters.
Why not just go whole hog, make it all Republicans?
Because you have pesky places like Charlotte and Raleigh and Durham that are critical masses of Democrats that makes it hard to sort of gerrymander around.
So to be clear, political gerrymandering has been deemed legal by the United States Supreme Court, and we've already gerrymandered to a fairly well so that Republicans win an outsized number of seats, and they're only going to gain one through this process. Catawba College political scientist Dr. Michael Bitzer says the likely target will be the first congressional district located in northeastern portion of the state. It's held by Democrat Don Davis. Will they stop there, or will this, or could they? I know a map has been drawn, but could they stop with just one seat?
You know, you mentioned Michael Bitzer. There was he played out a scenario where possibly they could find another seat or two. But to Ben's point, when you do that, the rubber band begins to stretch so far that it snaps and you have weaknesses in other areas. So I suspect they're going to probably end up stopping at one. But then again, let's look at the history. Anything can happen, as we've seen.
Mary.
This truly is a case of, you know, politicians picking their voters instead of voters picking their politicians, because we went from 7-7, which is sort of reflects North Carolina, to 10-4, strictly because of the lines being drawn in a different way. And some could say that that's the reason why the Republicans hold the majority in the US Congress, just by the shift of those seats. And though Dustin Hall, you know, the House Speaker, and Phil Berger, the leader of the Senate, are saying they're being very open about why, because they want Donald Trump's agenda to be safe, and they want him to win the House. And they're saying, well, it's because North Carolina has shown that they're behind the agenda 100%. Well, not really. And we have the backdrop of the Supreme Court now, which is looking to perhaps eviscerate what's left of the Voting Rights Act, which they're saying, well, you know, is racism done? Do we need to use race? But at the same time, we see a slew of Southern states planning out maps that might eliminate a lot of Democratic representation and African-American representation, which in the South and in many other places, racial and partisan gerrymandering really walk hand in hand. And they're saying, well, California started it. Well, not really. Texas did by saying that they were going to redistrict in the middle of a cycle. Yeah. And California at least is going to let voters decide whether or not they want this, because there will be a vote on that.
I was going to talk about that. Has House Speaker Justin Hall has blamed their move in Raleigh on Democrats, specifically California Democrats, the governor there. And he said, Destin Hall said, our state won't stand by while Democrats like Gavin Newsom redraw districts to aid in their effort to obtain a majority in the U.S. House. Is this the height of hypocrisy?
Well, definitely. It certainly is. He's ignoring Texas and the fact that California, at least voters, will have a say in it. And a lot of it, folks are saying it's because Donald Trump, many of his policies now are polling. He's very, very unpopular, even ones that were his strength, like immigration. A lot of folks don't like the images they're seeing of how this is being carried out by ICE. And so he fears that there will be a backlash in the midterms. So he is telling all of these states to do everything they can to make his majority bulletproof.
Ben.
The thing is, I mean, with gerrymandering, in its most generous interpretation, it's meant to remedy something. And of course, people will disagree with what the line should be, but it's meant to make things fairer according to one party. This actually sets even a different precedent than that, because I don't think anybody's making the argument that something needs to be remedied or fixed. This is, you know, General Assembly Republican leadership saying that they want to help the president out. So that would mean going forward, whether it's a Democrat or Republican, that when a president wins a state of North Carolina, that it is okay then to redraw lines after that in favor of that president's party, which is really a completely new interpretation of how gerrymandering is typically used.
I guess with everything else, it's accelerated. I mean, you know, it's just faster and faster.
As you would imagine, our governor, who's a Democrat, Josh Stein, says the General Assembly works for North Carolina, not Donald Trump. And he adds, these shameless politicians are abusing their power to take away yours. Of course, Democrats did the same thing when they were in charge, but not quite as surgically and not quite as shamelessly. All gerrymanders take away power from the voters and give it to leaders. Do citizens in North Carolina, I mean, the governor of California has to ask permission. They have a nonpartisan commission that draws voting districts in California. So he had to ask permission of voters to gerrymander California in favor of Democrats to counter Texas. Do we have any recourse? Do citizens have any recourse, Eric?
Not really is the answer. And the governor is not even involved, so you don't have to.
He can't veto this.
Yeah, you can't veto it. And then also the important thing about that, Mike, is, of course, you don't need the two-thirds majority to override a veto. You just need a simple majority of the legislature. Well, that's huge, because that's really easy given the numbers that the Republicans have in the General Assembly right now. So other than the endless parade of court cases that we see around almost every one of these, there's not much recourse.
Mary.
And I want to remind people about the Voting Rights Act, which was a remedy in 1965, because in so many states, and I would include our state, Black voters were disenfranchised, and there were huge percentages of the population. And we see in Louisiana, which is the case that's in the Supreme Court now, that white voters, or as they call themselves, non-minority voters or something, in the lawsuit are saying that they are being discriminated against. And as a result, we see even neighboring South Carolina trying to figure out a way to disenfranchise a huge portion of the population by eliminating the one Democratic seat, Congressman James Clyburn. So, you know, people really fought and died for these rights, and to see it being politicized in the name of just giving Donald Trump his way is really gutting for a lot of people. I had three older siblings that were involved in the civil rights movement. Well, so
it's are there
work, is there it's work for not?
It's undemocratic, Mary. It's undemocratic. Ben, go ahead.
The thing is, also keep in mind, this will eliminate the state's single swing district as it stands right now. All the other, with this, every single district in the state of North Carolina will be very predictable. Also keep in mind, the idea of gerrymandering is really unpopular across party lines. The last poll I saw was in September, and it had about 87% of Democrats in the state opposing it and 78% of Republicans. So you have broad bipartisan opposition to an issue like this.
It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup this morning on WFAE. To redraw these maps, they also have to call the General Assembly back into session. So, Eric, while they're at it, will they also address the budget, which they have yet to pass?
That's a great question. You mentioned Governor Stein. That was part of his message, is the legislature needs to be back in session, but not to redraw congressional maps, but to finish the budget. At least I have not, Ben, correct me if I'm wrong, I have not seen any sort of hints that the budget is going to be wrapped up in any way or really even addressed as part of this. I think they're still kicking that can farther down the road. And remember, the new calendar year, fiscal year for North Carolina started July 1st. We're almost to Halloween. It's not unprecedented, but it's not a real good track record.
Explain this to me. This is happening here, and it's happening at the national level, too. The Republican Party, in charge of both the Congress and this General Assembly, allegedly is the party of fiscal responsibility, and yet there seems to be no urgency to pass budgets in either body. Why?
Well, there is a key difference between federal and state, which is that you don't shut down at the state level.
Right.
You just keep the spending levels from the previous year. That makes it much easier to, try to leverage to the fullest extent what you want. And in this case, it's a disagreement between the Republican House and the Republican Senate. It's not Democrats really having much of a say at all. On the federal level, you're right. Obviously, Republicans have all three branches, but there at least is, some parliamentary maneuvering that can go on where they can blame Democrats. It's not even that in North Carolina.
Hmm. Well, all this is going on, of course, while early voting in this off-year election started yesterday and continues through Saturday, November the 1st. Election day itself is the following Tuesday, November the 4th. Turnout is always slim in these off-year elections, although there is this referendum for the 1% sales tax for transit on the ballot, which some believe may increase voter turnout a little bit. And although most of the races in Charlotte are kind of sewn up already, except in the 6th district city council race, it's not the case in Matthews. It's not the case in Cornelius. So are we anticipating greater turnout, perhaps, than we would normally see in an off-year election like this?
I think the transit issue certainly is going to be a driver for a lot of people. I would still assume that once all the numbers are crunched at the end of this, it being an off-year election, people talk about this all the time, is the wisdom of having an off-year election. And if there is wisdom, if you're wanting to encourage voter turnout, typically these off-year turnout is typically abysmal. We saw it in early voting. It wasn't that high in the primary. I don't anticipate it's going to be much higher this time.
Eric.
I believe it was 15% 2 years ago, so 10 to 15% is probably what we're looking at. But I want to salute Ben for saying transit will be a driver.
You're welcome. Thank you, folks.
Well, let's talk about it. I only have 20 seconds, but do we know what? Yesterday was the first day. There are limited locations where you can vote in Mecklenburg County. Do we know what the turnout was yet?
I pulled up the MEC BOE's website, and it is. I'm trying to refresh it, but I don't have any new numbers for
you. So they haven't posted anything. Solo, they haven't posted any numbers. We got to take a break.
We'll
come back with more in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at HabitatCharlotteRegion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Zach Taylor, our climate reporter. He will be here moments from now. Ben Thompson joins us. He's an anchor at WCNC TV. He's joining us from their newsroom. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast, joining us from her den. And Eric Spanberg is managing editor in bleak surroundings at the Charlotte Business Journal.
That's right. I'm at the office.
So earlier this year, Charlotte City Council's Victoria Watlington raised allegations and eyebrows. She alleged that she saw unethical, immoral, and possibly illegal conduct in the lead-up to the council's decision to settle a potential lawsuit from CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings. Mayor Vi Lyles was stung by those accusations, to put it mildly, and she and the majority of council pushed for an investigation.
These egregious allegations hurt our team, and we owe it to them to investigate. They work for an organization that can be trusted and operates with the highest degree of integrity.
So the results of that report came back this week. Ben, what did it find?
Not much. I mean, there was no merit, no fraud, no corruption, nothing illegal. It seemed like a big takeaway from the investigation and also from the audit from the state was that, you know what, this was lacking some transparency, folks. We should
the
expect
transparency investigation lacked transparency.
Yes. We should probably be able to expect a little bit more from our elected leaders and them being more transparent, but that was really about it. There was not any corruption, or there wasn't much there.
Who conducted the investigation, and who did they talk to?
I know Cranfield Sumner conducted the investigation. I'm not sure exactly who all within the city they talked to specifically, but that's who it was.
And speaking of transparency, Eric, they found nothing unethical, nothing immoral, nothing illegal. But they did say the city could have been more structured and transparent about the process. So the mayor held a news conference this week to announce this, yes, and then took no questions.
And took no questions, yes.
How is that transparent?
Yeah, that's not very transparent. And then I think, I hope I have this correct, I think Victoria Watlington, who sort of spurred this whole investigation, said that she was pleased with the results mostly, but she would have liked to have, I think she may have even used the word transparency, but the gist of it was she wanted a little more information on how the processes could have been better.
Here's exactly what she said.
I was able to submit in writing on public record my concerns in detail. I was able to participate in the investigation. I would have liked an analysis included in the report to really understand, because each of us are our own people, and we have our own interpretation, our own moral standard, our own what we consider unethical, our own interpretation of what's in the statutes and what is in our own ethics policy. And I respect that we can agree to disagree.
So it's open to interpretation. The report did say that Ms. Watlington's concerns appeared to, quote, center more on procedural issues than on any legal or ethical violation. And as you recall, she did try to walk back those initial accusations earlier in this conversation. Does this end this free-for-all, this brouhaha?
Yes. It's over? I think everybody's had enough of this one.
Okay. Yesterday, the U.S. Attorney's Office accused a prominent Charlotte housing activist, Cedric Dean, of health care fraud in a civil court filing, and it said it was seizing property owned by Dean in a raid on his home in the Palisades in southwest Charlotte. What is he accused of, Eric?
He is accused of essentially filing fraudulent Medicaid claims and using the money for other things. He was, I believe, the only person listed in the filing that there was mention of conspirators from the reporting that I saw. So don't know who else is alleged to be involved, but obviously he has been a prominent advocate for housing in the Charlotte area. I believe he attended State of the Union address a few years ago as the guest of Congresswoman Alma Adams. And so this is very surprising, to say the least, to see this play out.
Ben.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a consumer of news, which you probably are if you're listening to us on a Friday morning, but if you are, you probably will recognize this guy or at least his name. I mean, he's in the news quite a lot as a community activist. His drug program or drug recovery program help made news this summer because it took over North Charlotte Hotel, but then had substantial safety issues and then pulled back out. And so he's been sort of a forefront of some of these issues, but I mean, some of the allegations in this report, if proven true, are really damning. I mean, the idea that he had groups going and targeting vulnerable homeless people at shelters, at encampments we see along the interstate, offering them free food, temporary housing, that sort of stuff, all in a way to get their Medicaid ID numbers and then use that and not pass along any of the benefits to those people.
So here's a question. This was a civil filing, not a criminal filing. Why?
Good question.
Okay. As a side note, Cedric Dean, who has been a guest on this program, by the way, is an ally of Charlotte City Council member Tijuana Brown, who was indicted on different fraud charges in an alleged scheme to obtain fraudulent COVID-19 relief funds. Is there any connection at all between these two cases?
No. Yeah, she's not part of this investigation at all.
Okay, that's actually good to know.
He was the best of America, and also he was the best of Charlotte. Someone who, when they came to Charlotte, he didn't just set up a company. He got involved in this community in so many ways and gave back more than most people realize. And he never really called attention to himself. Only to his causes.
That's former Charlotte mayor and former governor Pat McCrory talking about his friend Doug Lebda, the CEO of LendingTree, who died last Sunday. What do we know about what happened in that ATV accident, Eric?
We know that he was alone. As you mentioned, this happened on an ATV. He was on property, roughly 200 acres or so, in Tryon, North Carolina, where he had just bought a farm. And when I spoke to Governor McCrory, he said the farm was sort of the pride and joy of Doug Lebda's here of late. That's what we know, is that he was alone, there was an accident, and he was found. And he has passed away at age 55. And as you mentioned, LendingTree, is pretty much a homegrown company that is now a billion-dollar company with over 1,000 employees worldwide.
Let's talk about this. LendingTree was in Ballantyne. It moved recently to Southend. It operates an online marketplace. If people don't know what LendingTree is, it's a place where people looking for loans are connected with lenders online. They employ, I am told, over 1,000 people, and they have revenues of approaching
$900 million. Yeah, they were $900 million last year, probably going to get to $1 billion this year.
Talk about the impact of that company on this region.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, they have had a large impact, not just from the dollars and the employees, Mike, but the fact that they are, what people call fintech, which is financial technology. You're just marrying banking or finance with technology. Obviously, you were mentioning that when you go to LendingTree, you can sort of bargain hunt for car loan, mortgage, credit card, those kinds of things. This all came out of Doug Lebda's own experience trying to get his first mortgage many years ago, and he was in accounting and thought, well, why isn't there a way to get this information faster and to get it all in one place? And that's what led to the creation of LendingTree. And then the other important point from the company standpoint, Mike, is that they, as you say, they were in Ballantyne. They moved a few years ago into Southend, and they were one of the companies that started this wave of companies opening offices in Southend and making it more than just an entertainment district. So he had a lot of influence here and beyond.
So was his difficulty getting a mortgage prior to his being a partial owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers?
Yes, I believe it was.
Pat McCrory referred to what Doug Lebda gave back to the community. He was one of the three co-chairs who successfully led the city's bid in 2018 to host the 2020 Republican National Convention, which of course was truncated because of the pandemic. But what were some of his other involvements in Charlotte?
He had given, I believe, $1 million to the COVID-19 recovery fund that was started almost immediately when COVID shut down the country. He had more recently given, I believe, $500,000 for a rural healthcare effort. And his company was very much known for encouraging their employees, for getting employees out into the community for various efforts. So, you know, it's interesting. He was involved in politics, as you mentioned, with the RNC. He was involved in philanthropy. He was involved in sports. You mentioned the Steelers. His company was also a big sponsor of the Hornets for many years. So Doug Lebda kind of had his hand in all kinds of aspects of the Charlotte community. Yeah.
He was a doer. That's what entrepreneurs do. He founded LendingTree in 96. He grew it from nothing into one of the city's most prominent homegrown financial companies. And just weeks ago, he appeared on the Deal Ranch podcast with Matt Lutz and talked about getting things done in business instead of just talking about it.
People love to say, like, either we should or, like, well, we should focus on the customer experience. Something like, that's a really nice comment in a meeting. I love to turn those into I wills.
Right.
And so you identify the issue, recommend a problem, and then ask for the ball. So you can't just say
execute.
Yeah, and then go execute. Say, like, listen, I want to fix this. Here's what we need, and go do it.
Governor McCrory said he considered Lebda one of America's greatest entrepreneurs. Doug was 55. Well, after a city council committee declined to comment on the process by which city council will choose members of the new 27 member transportation authority, should the transit referendum pass, council went ahead and approved the plan anyway. So, Ben, what is the plan? How are they going to appoint these people?
So I think there's 125 people who applied in all. 30 of those people will be interviewed by the end of the month by three members, I believe, at the transportation committee there at city council, but all council members can take part if they choose to. In the end, seven will be appointed by council, I believe two by the mayor. They'll make those decisions in the early part of November, which coincidentally is the same time people are voting on whether or not we're going to have said authority.
I'm going to talk about that. But first, last week we talked about the fact that there were members of council who were uncomfortable with the fact that three people, Ed Driggs, James Mitchell, and Luana Mayfield, would be interviewing these people and making the decisions on who they would recommend for a final vote to council because they felt it gave them too much power. How did they get beyond that?
Well, I think the big thing is that all council members can attend these interviews. And then from a public standpoint, these interviews will all be streamed. So there is no even hint of a secret meeting of, you know, whatever kind, nothing. If anybody is worried about nefarious goings on, it's all right there. It's going to be, as I say, streamed to the public. And then the rest of the council can come. Not only can they attend, they can ask questions of the candidates. And so I think that really soothed a lot of the worries that you heard the week before in the committee meeting.
So 126 or so people have applied. 30 will be interviewed. 7 will be voted on sometime in November, as Ben, you pointed out, before we know whether or not people will say yes or no to this 1% sales tax for transit. And one council member, Renee Perkins Johnson, questioned the wisdom of spending so much time on this effort if it's all for naught, because she asked, what's the harm of waiting one additional week? Because if there is no yes vote, there is no transit authority. What is the harm in waiting a week? Why the hurry?
I think what you will hear, or what you are hearing from, I guess, transit advocates, people that want this to pass, is that they don't have time to wait because the transit authority is supposed to be in place by the start of December, and they have, I think, 5 or 6 reports that are due to the legislature by the end of December, and then they start work, for real, for lack of a better term, in January. And, Mike, I think your next question or next thought would be, well, why not just slow those pieces down a little bit, and then you can, kind of get the things in the right order. And no one has stopped to do that, or they don't think they can do that. But it is odd how time crunched all this has ended up being.
Which is not unusual for
No.
City council. One member of council expressed interest on being in being on the Transit Commission, and you can't be on the Transit Authority if you are a sitting member of council. And that person is Marjorie Molina, but she's not going to be a sitting member of council when this commission forms because she lost her reelection bid. Is she among the candidates they will be considering now?
I'm not sure where that stands as of now. I know that was an interest, but I'm not sure if that's still, if she's included in that 125 people or 126 people. I think to your prior question, I think there is undoubtedly a PR issue here the city has to think about. And I think it wants to make sure it is looking like it is ready, prepared, and ready to go come the November election. This is something they fought for literally years. And so I think there's part of it that they want to be seen as being ready and not having to wait.
It's the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Eric.
And remember, Mike, that there are three appointments from the state, the governor, the House Speaker, and the Senate President. Two of those, the Senate President and the House Speaker, have made their appointments, and those appointments are Ned Curran, who used to chair the Transportation Board, and David Longo, who now chairs the board of the Charlotte Regional Business Alliance. And they have already started preliminary work to try and get some of these things done, or at least in motion, while they wait for the rest of the board to be appointed. Now, critics of the tax referendum and this whole plan say, wait a minute, why are two people out here kind of, you know, making plans while we don't even know if there's going to be an authority? So that's yet another thing to put in the pot.
I want to change subjects here completely, and in the 90 seconds we have left here, bring in Zach for this conversation. Zach Turner, our climate reporter. Duke Energy's 2025 resource plan forecasts an unprecedented rise in energy demand, which could grow at 8 times the rate it did in the past 15 years. So which that brings us to renewable energy. And this week, you reported on an effort to lower the cost of installing solar for residents in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. I've looked into this. It's expensive. Do tell.
So, I mean, this is coming at a pretty, I guess, fortuitous time because we've just lost, or we're about to lose at the end of the year, the federal clean energy tax credits, which is going to make it harder for folks to afford solar. So this program is a group purchase program, which means that the more people that buy into it, the lower the cost gets. And right now, Solarize Charlotte-Mecklenburg, the Solarize Charlotte-Mecklenburg program has gotten the cost below $2 a watt, which is pretty good for solar.
But you have to act now, as
yes,
they say.
Yes, before the end of the month.
Wow. okay. And is it will it substantially offset your electricity prices over time? Do you know?
It should. I mean, it's one of those things. They'll send out, Renew Energy will send out somebody to give you a free consultation, and they'll be able to assess whether or not that'll be economic for you in the long run.
Okay. Too old for this, but I'll look into it anyway. We're taking a break. We're coming right back.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the Gambrill Center at Queens, presenting Earthwise, a public series exploring our connection to nature through science, film, art, literature, and lived stories, part of their Connected Campus program. More at gambrillcenter.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the Local News Roundup. Zach Turner's with us, our climate reporter for WFAE News. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com, a host of their Equal Time podcast. Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. And Ben Thompson is anchor at WCNC-TV. Early Monday morning, a woman was shot on Barclay Downs Drive, or just off Barclay Downs Drive near South Park, in a gated garage in a luxury apartment complex that requires a key fob to get into, Ben. The woman, 45-year-old Dewanich Hammonds, I hope I said her name correctly, later died. Have police identified a suspect?
Not yet, but something important to say that they pointed out that they do not believe there's an ongoing threat. And when we hear phrases like that in the newsroom, it makes us believe that this might be people who knew each other, or perhaps a domestic situation or something like that. We don't know that yet, but when police say something like that, they don't believe there's an ongoing threat, is that they don't necessarily believe it was a random situation.
This is a luxury apartment garage. As I said, it requires a key fob to get into, although residents have said if you open the gate to get in, someone can easily follow you in behind you. But are there not security cameras?
I'm not sure on security cameras. I'd assume there would be, especially at an establishment like that, and in a, you know, a place like that. But I don't know, to be honest, off the top of my head.
Well, I bring this up because despite that incident and the high profile instance of Irina Zarutska and her stabbing death on the Blue Line in August, CMPD reported this week that crime is down. What do these third quarter crime statistics show us?
Well, crime down overall 8%. Surprisingly, to a lot of people, violent crime down 20%. Property crime down 5%. And then the things that you want going up, evidently going up. Arrests up 15%. Firearm seizure up 25%. So it's numbers that, you know, city leaders like to tout because they say, hey, that might be this perception, but we've got numbers showing otherwise.
Eric?
I thought there were a couple of interesting things out of this. The CMPD representatives were very careful to say that even though the numbers are down, the perception and the impact of people affected by crime who, you know, had family members who were victims or friends, it remains very powerful and very concerning. And Ben just mentioned firearm seizures are up 25%. That's good and bad. I mean, it's good that more guns are being seized, but it also means there are a lot more guns out there. And the other thing that struck me, Mike, is, you know, part of this perception, well, between 2014 and 2018, typically Charlotte was in the range of 40 to 60 homicides, give or take. Then you get into 2020, the pandemic year, you set a record with 123, and it's been in the range of 100 or so every year. So that's why even when it goes down somewhat this year through three quarters, it's still a lot higher than what people were used to 7-8 years ago.
So because of the perception that Charlotte is no longer safe, there have been image campaigns launched, and in the aftermath of the stabbing death on the Blue Line, CMPD has launched several initiatives to get some more control on crime in certain areas of town, including the entertainment district. But Deputy Chief Jackie Briley says the department's efforts continue to face challenges.
Unfortunately, alcohol and guns, people don't make good decisions. And there are some things that we're trying to prevent that's in our control. And there are some things that if people are going to resort to guns to settle a petty argument, that's hard to prevent.
So CMPD says it has seized 25% more firearms and made 15% more arrests. That's all in the third quarter?
That's through 9 months. Okay. So for the first three quarters.
Okay, so let's bring Zach back into this conversation. Some areas that are being considered as locations for data centers have gotten pushback in recent months around the country and here in this area, and with some success. But Uptown Charlotte has a data center proposed that's moving forward without a vote and without public discussion. And City Council's Luana Mayfield is a little concerned about that.
This current development is by right, meaning it does not come before council. There's no discussion. There's no vote on it.
So we already have some data centers uptown, I believe. Where is this one? Why is it going through with no discussion? What does by right mean?
Right. So this is in First Ward area. It's going to be a 12-megawatt data center, which as far as data centers go is pretty small. The same company, Digital Realty, is going to be building or is applying to build a 400-megawatt data center right next to the Catawba River, like a little bit northwest of the airport. The reason why, so the kind of main arena in which people can kind of get their say in when it comes to data centers is whenever you have a rezoning petition. And so for this type of development and the buildings that Digital Realty has purchased, I guess according to the UDO, this by right zoning means that they don't have to go through that rezoning process, which doesn't give folks an opportunity to express their opinion.
And she's also concerned because these data centers that are being built today evidently require more resources than the ones that were built in the past. What kind of resources are we talking about?
Well, the main one that, I mean, what comes up a lot is water resources and energy resources. The one that I'm more intimately familiar with are energy resources. Like I mentioned, the one that, for example, the one in Matthews that was proposed would have required 600 megawatts of power. To put that into perspective, you look at Sharon Harris Nuclear Reactor out in Wake County, that creates about 900 megawatts of power. So you're talking about a little over half of a nuclear reactor to power one of these larger data centers. And so that's a major concern, because if you have a lot of data centers coming to a state like North Carolina, then you're going to need to build out a lot more energy generation, and that cost could potentially get passed on to ratepayers.
So who supplies these extra, like the water? And there's water is connected to power, because we did a program on this several years ago. Every time you turn the light switch on, you're dealing with water usage, because they have to cool the plants, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, and you have to pump the it's a lot of stuff.
So go back and watch the episode. Yeah,
that's right. Go listen to it. It's on the web someplace. Who supplies these extra resources? The city, the power company, the Charlotte Water. Who pays for all this?
Yeah, that's a good question. In terms of the water usage, I'm less familiar with, and that's something that would be a great conversation for us to have with the Catawba Riverkeeper, for example. But in terms of energy resources, that's going to be something that is a discussion between the data centers, the utilities, in this case Duke Energy, and our utilities commission.
So this is happening all over the country. This is because big data and now artificial intelligence requires these server farms that are enormous in scope and enormous in their use of electricity. Lucas Fikes is the energy policy director of the Data Center Coalition. He says these centers, though, are economic generators.
As you bring in data centers to North Carolina, you're also going to bring in other operations that depend on data centers and depend on reducing that latency, that data transfer time.
So how are they economic generators? Yes, it costs, you bring in people to build these centers, you bring in electricians to wire them, then they all go away. It's just computers in a big building, right?
No, it's a good point, because I think the main economic benefit in terms of jobs, right, is coming from the construction of these data centers. But after about, over like 12 to 16 months, the data center is constructed, and then you have 50 full-time jobs about at these data centers. But what Fikes was getting at is maybe some of these other tangential benefits of having a data center, such as drawing in more business. When he was talking about latency, one of the examples he provided was like advanced robotics. If you're going to have these high-tech companies that are coming in and they're going to depend on having just like to be somewhat in proximity to data centers in order to relocate a campus or something to North Carolina, which could, as Fikes is making this argument, could lead to more high-paying jobs in the area. Another argument you hear in favor of data centers, or you'll hear from developers, comes down to tax revenue for an area. They can be a substantial source of tax revenue, and this was certainly the argument that was being made in Matthews before they pulled that project.
So in your story on this on our website, you quote Tommy Tucker. He's a North Carolina utility commissioner, and he spoke with the group of energy experts in Raleigh this week as the state prepares for a wave of new data centers. Here's what he said, and then I want you to explain it.
I'm just thinking about the guy out there in rural North Carolina that needs a good paying job. Why wouldn't we go after that load and kind of sidestep some of the data centers?
So what's he talking about? Moving these things into rural areas to improve their economies because they don't employ that many people. What's he talking about?
Yeah, so, I mean, what Tucker's basically saying is that he's making this comparison between data centers, which is a large load customer. They require a lot of energy versus other types of manufacturing. One example I can think of right off the top of my head is the Toyota battery manufacturing plant in Liberty, North Carolina, where you're going to have like somewhere in the neighborhood of maybe 500 employees versus something like a data center where you're having 50 employees. And then what we hear from the data centers, like there's a representative from Google who was talking during this conference earlier this week in Raleigh about these large loads and data centers coming to North Carolina, is that there are some other benefits for these communities, like upgrading local transmission. These data centers, they'll often reach a deal with a utility like Duke Energy to pay for the upgrades necessary to connect them to the grid. But that doesn't mean that they're going to necessarily pay the full share of the cost of upgrading new generation systems like new natural gas turbines or procuring new solar or other resources like that.
So this is a conversation around the country because these evidently are impacting ratepayers with rising electricity costs. Some economists think, well, electricity like gasoline goes up, it goes down. But it's clear that these data centers consume incredible amounts of power,
yeah,
which require more power plants or more windmills or solar to produce that power. And somebody has to pay for that in the short term. Why don't they pay for it? These are big companies. These are the Metas and the Googles of the world.
Right. And that is something that was in discussion this week during the Large Load Technical Conference in Raleigh, where we had a group of energy experts coming together in front of the Utility Commission to discuss ways in which you could structure tariffs and these rate case hearings in such a way that these data centers and these other large load customers would be paying a greater share of the cost to upgrade these energy generation sources. Another thing that came up, I know we've talked a lot about transparency during this show already, but having more transparency about how we're calculating how many data centers are coming into North Carolina and what exactly is in these utilities development queue. And that was a big topic of conversation this past week.
Okay, well, we'll follow this because this is going to be ongoing. A misunderstanding about anticipated funding levels for Union County schools emerged this week, Ben. When Union County passed its budget earlier in the year, the commissioners expected they expected the $8.8 million increase in funding to the schools would go toward increasing teacher salary supplements, and now the schools have decided to delay salary increases of about $1,000 per teacher. And that has at least one county commissioner, Melissa Merrill, up there, upset and surprised that the county commission is getting the blame.
I was, one, shocked that they didn't get it. And then I was shocked that this board was blamed for them not getting it.
So this is all very confusing. She sent an open letter to the Union County School Board asking for transparency. What a concept.
There you go.
And better communication with teachers. Why all the confusion? What's the deal here?
Well, I think both sides at this point admit that there's just a miscommunication here. You are correct. The county commission has approved the extra money for teacher supplements, which, by the way, for folks who don't realize, there's usually a state pay that the state provides, and then local counties, Mecklenburg does it as well. Union provides an additional supplement to pay teachers more. So the county there in Union County approved it, passing it along, thinking it was going to just happen immediately. The school district says, you know what, we were going to wait till we knew the state budget. To our prior conversation, we do not have a state budget. So those teacher raises, those teacher supplements have not been passed along yet.
Oh, do they anticipate passing them along in the near future?
There's a committee meeting coming up in the next week or two, I think, where they hope to have a little bit more transparency.
It's the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Yesterday, on Thursday, it was announced that one of the founding mothers of NPR, Susan Stamberg, died. She was among the original staffers at National Public Radio in 1971 when it first went on the air. And although she started off as an off-air employee, she eventually found herself in the anchor chair as the first woman to host a nightly national news program, all things considered. Her style was unique and personable, and she believed in the power of great journalism. Stamberg's son, Josh, said that her life's work was connection through ideas and culture. And here's how Susan Stamberg explained her approach to reporting on things like visual art on this program several years ago.
I was determined I was going to hold that picture up so you would see it through your radio. That was my goal. And I have another goal, and it is that I assume very few people are really interested in any of this. I am. It's my passion, but I don't think you all are. So I've got to grab you. I've got to grab your ear and do it as well as I possibly can.
Susan Stamberg officially retired from NPR on September 1st. She died yesterday at the age of 87. So the Panthers are 3-3 on the season, but the good news is that although they've had some disappointing outings, they've also had some exciting ones, including last Sunday's game where they beat the Cowboys. What? The Cowboys 30-27 at home. Quarterback Bryce Young.
It's a week-to-week league. Right now, you know, we're excited. We're enjoying this win. But, you know, next week we're going to turn the page. And, you know, it's for us, you know, we have to figure out to be consistent. You know, we have to put them together. We have to continue to stack again. Right now, for 24 hours, we're going to enjoy it, but, you know, we're going to come back. We already talked about in the locker room. Everyone's dedicated to moving forward, so that's all it is. We want to go 1-0 next week.
So next week is Sunday, and Sunday's game is on the road, and it's against the New York Jets. And here's the really good news. The Jets, Mary, are winless.
Yeah, but don't take it for granted because they have lost all their away games. But they do have a great running back, Rico Dowdle, who's been really killing it. So let's see. Okay. If everybody shows up, they have a shot.
And every week is different. Every week is a surprise. Sometimes good, sometimes bad.
That's our Panthers.
I always check my phone at halftime, and if it's going to be good, I'll watch the rest of the game. That's Mary C. Curtis, columnist for RollCall.com. Ben Thompson joined us today, anchor for WCNC-TV. Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. And Zach Turner, our climate reporter here at WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.